kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello, and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 115. Yes, this is the Tide Podcast, and I am Di Barnes, and this is...
Doug Belshaw. How are you doing, Di?
I am good, actually. Yeah, I'm quite pleased. I've been injured for a while running, and I've just got back going this week, and I'm really pleased to be back out on the road. So I'm on a bit of an up today. Happy days. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm good. So lots to talk about because we haven't done a podcast for a while, but I've seen you in between, I'd bet. Indeed. And this is the last day. So we're recording this on the last day of January, which will be important for what we talk about later. And it's the evening of the 31st. So for the people who have done dry January or Veganuary or red, which is run every day, my wife has done three of those. She had a burger for tea, so I can let you guess which one of which two those were. It's a big deal because tomorrow you can eat meat or, I don't know, drink alcohol or not go for a run.
Okay, well, I haven't done any of those things. So I like the run every day one, though. I quite like running.
Mm. Well, she's not running every day. She's like going to the. She's alternating going to the gym and running.
Yeah, but doing something every day, I think, is really important. Yeah. I think running every day is good. I think people should run most days, 6 out of 7, to be honest. But I can't
really?
Do that.
Well, okay.
No, I think it's. I don't think you have to run far. You don't have to run fast. But I think getting your body up there and doing that, I think it's. I think running is fabulous. And everyone should do it. I think I'm biased, though.
I've been back to tracking my habits this month, which I don't think we mentioned last time. Just using a very simple habit tracker called Loop Habit Tracker. Did we talk about that?
I think you did mention it for some reason. Okay. I can't remember what you said about it, but there's nothing unusual in that.
No. But what it's meant is that I have, you know, I'm realistic. I know that I'm not going to go every single day. So running for 6 days out of 7, like you mentioned. And I have either swam, run, or gone to the gym 6 days out of 7 all month, which is great. And I've lost 1.7 kilograms.
Oh, well, I haven't found them. I'll have a look. I guess if we're talking about that, I have to mention that, do you know what I have not done today?
What's that?
Well, you have to work it out. It's a game.
Put on any clothes.
Nope, I have been clothed most of the day.
Had a shower.
Good guess, but I went running. I showered afterwards.
You haven't had anything to eat.
Also a good guess. You know my dietary habits, but yes, I've eaten twice today.
You haven't smoked.
Correct. Well done.
Very good.
That's a big deal. I have not had a cigarette today. I have contraband from our pupils in house where they get their vaping machines stolen from them. So I'm trying a vaping machine. And I absolutely hate it, but it means, you know, I've got to that point in my life where I feel like I can't let the cigarettes just own me every day. And so I'm not sure I'm going to give up smoking, but I'm definitely going to get in charge of it a little bit more. Anyway, there we go.
Very good.
Happy days.
Well, I've been drinking whiskey and yeah, we'll see how it goes. I don't like making big pronouncements about what I'm going to do. I like just saying that I'm going to not do something for a while.
Yeah. No, I don't. So I've kept it very quiet. I haven't told anyone. So I've had, okay. I had 4 cigarettes 2 days ago, 3 cigarettes, 2 cigarettes yesterday and no cigarettes so far today. And really all I want to do is not smoke until after lunch and not to be slave to it. I don't like that. But wow, do I have complex arguments with myself in my head.
It is. Or trying to rationalize why you can have just this one.
Just about desire. Just about why should I stop doing this thing? So it's possibly my second favorite activity in the whole world is smoking a cigarette, as in things that I do with my body or whatever. And not having it makes it more lovely. And it's weird. I don't have any.
I'm not going to ask you what your favorite thing that you do with your body is.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to say that.
So I saw you at BET, which was great.
It was good.
Introduce you to Laura, who you met for the first time, Laura Hilligan.
I met Laura Hilliger for the first time and Grainne Hamilton for the first time too. And it was very, very lovely to meet them. But it was great to meet Laura in particular. So we've had talked and talked on video chat before a couple of years ago now, and which was good fun. Good. So I've known her and her work for quite a while. And so it's good to actually meet her.
Mm-hmm. Fun. So there was a bit of a table of us, wasn't there? There was Gavin, who has recently left Moodle. Garnet, who still works in Moodle. There was me. Yeah. Who else was there?
Brian.
John and Brian and Grainne and Laura. Oh, no, John wasn't there. John was in Munich.
John was not there.
Yeah, so it was good to get the lots of people together. And then you and I met up with Oliver Quinlan afterwards as well.
We did see Oliver. Hey, Oliver, if you're listening. Yeah. That was lovely to see him. Everything's going very well at the Raspberry Pi Foundation, and they're growing. So he was really relieved not to have to be manning bet stands for 4 days straight. Mm-hmm. And
who else did you see that? I saw Alan O'Donohoe. I saw Paul Hudson at Night Zookeeper.
I didn't see many people really, but I did see favorite people. So I saw Elan Ezekiel, who's a very good friend of mine and a friend of Tide Podcast as well. And I saw Gideon Williams, who is the head of... does my job essentially at the British School in the Netherlands, who I've talked about before, runs a one-to-one program, was one of the first one-to-one programs in the United Kingdom, down in Southampton or Hampshire or somewhere. And it's always a pleasure to meet up with his Scottish sourness.
I don't think I've ever met him, so.
Okay. He has this thing, because he works on his PLN all year long and talks to people and this, that, and the other, and they come to bet. And I don't do much of that anymore. And he comes to bet and he just gets blanked by everybody and everyone opens their arms for me. And he's just like, it's not fair. And I'm like, you're right, it's not fair. When I agree, he's the most overlooked, underrated professionals in digital education. Okay. Yeah, that's what I really
did mean. You see anything at bet which amazed you and made you want to go running screaming back to Oundle and say we must implement this right
I
now?
I talked to a lot of people. I met a guy called Pete Hare or O'Hare or something, whose name is Pizza Joke on Twitter, which is very funny because he's called Pete and Pizza Joke, but it's actually the food pizza. And a few other people, and I talk about my digital strategy. I went to a networking event on the Thursday night with the Tablet Academy, which is hosted by the RAF Club over in some posh place in London, and which was very nice, and met some people there and just talked digital things. Met Yvonne Baker, who is a member of STEM Learning, an engineer, senior at STEM Learning, and talked to her for a while. Met Rachel Evans, who is the head of digital innovation in learning at Wimbledon High School, and some other people, and sort of network with them, talk digital strategy and this and the other. And you know, it's weirdly, I'm the only person in the world that thinks we should slow down digital strategies and look after what we do in the classroom more. So I had lots of really healthy arguments with people. It was quite fun.
You do have the luxury, and we have talked about this before, you do have the luxury of being in a school which has amazing results without using as much technology as other schools.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's true. I'm not sure what our value added is, to be honest. And we are very selective and all of that, which probably is not great in some way. And what else? But anyway, so I talked about that. What was I impressed by? Dell have produced the new Latitude 3130 or something, which is an inking Surface Pro-like device, but it's a hybrid that folds over, but the keyboard doesn't come off. £300, runs at 4 gigabit RAM on a 64K Celeron processor or something. 64 gig of hard drive, SSD, and then a Celeron processor. It was really awesome. It was really good, actually. I was really impressed. There were lots of devices that Microsoft are saying inking for less money. Have a look. And that was the best one. So that's sort of coming on a little bit. A doorbell just rang. Was that you or me?
It wasn't me.
Okay. I don't have any doorbell software, and it didn't sound like my actual doorbell. Oh, well. Let me just check. Hang on.
Okay.
I wasn't amazed by that, but I just thought that was a decent product. They get released in April, that suite of products made by HP and other companies. Some Chinese companies coming into this sort of laptop-y market.
Yeah, the Chinese, there was a real Chinese kind of influence, wasn't it? I remember when I went to Bet, was it last year or the year before, there was like one thing from Shenzhen. And now when you went into N8, which is where they kind of funneled you in, there was a big stand and it seemed to be like personalized hardback textbooks on demand. And I pointed one of these out to you, was it, or to someone? And they pointed out the fact that actually one of the big titles on the stand itself spelt education incorrectly.
You did point that out to me. I remember that. And it's, but that's kind of how it, that is the style of things. It's getting very much more international and you're going to get those typos. You do that in an international school. If you teach international students, as I do, and you realize that that just comes your way.
And so there was Bet, which seemed to be a bit more focused on like showcasing ed tech from different countries this year. And then there was the education show, which I didn't go into on the other side of Bet.
Elan jumped in there for a while and said it was a bit, it said it was okay. He picked up some goodies, but it wasn't, they were obviously having an identity crisis of some sort. It wasn't as good as the place when he'd been to it in another location. He said it was better. And that's that. There were people, I mean, the stands were smaller. Microsoft were owning the yard. And so that, you know, they are winning out with surfaces, I have to say. Surface technology is phenomenal, even though the machines, unless you're running 16 gig of RAM, the machines leave something to be desired in my mind, even though I've just bought 160 of them or whatever. 4 gig with 4 gig of RAM, but my RAM runs at 80% with, well, 60 something percent with nothing running, because it has so many internal processors in the bloatware of Windows 10.
Good old Microsoft.
Yeah, well, you see, it's a difficult thing because you're, it's not that simple story, I'm afraid. They are better than Apple. They are better than Google. They work in the classroom. They make sense. And it's really interesting. But they are not yet good enough. And then so Microsoft's taken massive loss leaders in developing the Surface product, that tablet product with a detachable keyboard. Massive loss leaders. The pen at £100, massive loss leader. So much R&D they put into it, and they are reaping the rewards of it. Schools are opting for their product. You know, no one will be talking about iPads in schools. No one will be talking about any of that anymore. Chromebooks are the cheap option. But with these cheaper Surface devices that are running Windows 10 and handling it, then, you know, there's they're going to push that market as well. And they are going to do very well. So this year in digital education, dear listener, it's all about Microsoft Surface, I'm afraid, whether you like Windows 10 or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a look around and, I mean, it's a bit of a fashionable thing to say, isn't it? They're like, oh, I went to Bet and I didn't see anything new. But like, really, I was looking for stuff which was like, it would amaze me or be different or whatever. I don't know if it's because of the general malaise in the country right now around Brexit and the world in general, but there did seem to be a lot of doubling down on existing technologies to make them smoother or fit in better with existing policies. It seemed to be a bit more about integration for me anyway. So I wasn't there long.
Let me think. I kind of think, I mean, it was same old really. There's lots of shiny tech out there. I mean, it was exactly the same as a year ago when there were, you know, new devices being released that are not yet there. There was a wonderful company called Impero, I think, and they were talking about the next generation cloud massive opening thing, and they covered all their very impressive stand with this opening thing. And when someone went to see if they could look at the cloud product that they were advertising, they said, I'm sorry, it's not quite ready yet. Can I show you something else instead? But they'd obviously designed all their billboarding, you know, and posters and whatever around this product that didn't work.
That is the danger, isn't it? When any organization, so I'm feeling this at the minute, we'll talk later about MoodleNet, but you know, you've got the marketing team, and then you've got the development team, and then you've got the management team. And the bigger the organization, the more disconnect there is between those.
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's a tricky thing. The Google stand was really interesting. So they did. So Google took a different take this year, as far as I could tell. There were teachers showing stuff, which is the usual thing that Google would do, but they just sold it out to loads of third parties. So what they weren't Googlers, they were third party companies. Saw this really impressive app called Squid, which if you run an Android tablet, it's a must if you're interested in inking on that tablet. And that's really, really cool. So I met the man who had made it and his wife and his brother. And so it's a little family business, really lovely. Do you know what I mean? And it was lots of bit like that. There are a lot of robots at Bert, robots galore. And I'm just going to say this. I don't know if I told you this at Bert, but I'm just going to say this out loud to the world. Robots are, for want of a better phrase, pet projects that you do at home. Having robots in school is okay, and to do in clubs and stuff like that, I get that, but it's not teaching. It's not what Bert's for. It's and it's really so. I find it really difficult. Anyway, so
yeah, I know what you mean. There's a lot of stuff which is designed to catch the eye, or you know, get the press.
Yeah, I mean, it's very exciting, and yes, I do want robots to excite the children in my classroom. Into studying computer science in some way. Yes, I do want that. And I get that that's important and we can afford that and we do not have any of it. And there's a reason that we don't. It's because what you do when you come into our classroom is you code, and that is what you do.
Yeah, indeed. And I forgot, I did see one other person, the inimitable Graham Brown-Martin, who was on the PyTop stand. And
yes,
they had the best coffee at Bet, I'm told. I don't drink coffee anymore. But introduced them to the gang, and then had a whistle stop tour of what they're doing. But you know, they've got the Raspberry Pi and putting it in different things. But like, you had to 3D print most of the stuff that they were showing.
I know. So I looked at the PyTop products. We have PyTop laptops, PyTop 1 or 2, I think. And so there's now PyTop 3. The laptop looks great. It's 220 quid, 250 quid with a Pi in it. And you get this sort of little breadboard and bits and pieces that go with it. I think you get everything that goes with that. And that's a lot of money. You know, you could buy a computer for that. So you have to, the only reason that I was interested in that product was because we're having difficulty implementing our Raspberry Pi unit of work this year because of the way that the rooms in our relocation last summer, the way the rooms have turned out, we're going to have to put in a dedicated Raspberry Pi room, which is just going to be Raspberry Pis and not computers alongside them, which is what we normally do. So that's that. And then the Pi 4 looks really awesome, but it's exactly what you say. It's just so many 3D printed parts to do your awesome things. It does look awesome, like, but they're pet projects. They're projects that dads and children should be getting into. I say that with such misogyny in my mind. The adult and a child will get into and do together, or a teen, you know, so they're funky robot dancing, and there was things going in the sky, making... what are they called? You have one hanging on your drones, making drones, yeah. So you can go and hijack airports and all that kind of thing. So really, really exciting work, but not for school. And that was, to me, that was not okay, really. If I was a PyTop, that's what I'd be focusing on. How do we get this product into schools? How do we make it fantastic?
So yeah, it's pies
in the
it?
Hands of pupils. Anyway,
so Bet is what Bet is, and it's the people who make it. It's a shame. I mean, I did see some pictures from the Teach Meet on Friday night, which seemed to be in an off-site location this year. But it was the old gang.
Yes. So I didn't attend, unfortunately. I had a meeting with a parent on Friday night, in central London. So I had to go to that. Teach Me Bet looked really good. It was in the Tapa Tapa Bar, which is on the way out from the tube station, the custom tube station to Custom House, whatever it's called, to Bet's doors. And Bet no longer wanted to run that Teach Meet. So they ran an international Teach Meet on the Wednesday night, I believe, which is kind of cool for the international schools, because obviously that's a different thing. International education is such a big deal right now. So I think that there must be, I don't know any figures, but I just get the sense that there are more international jobs out there. Teachers are considering teaching abroad as a very serious career stage. If you're a teacher, you know, so you get fed up with teaching in the UK and under the UK system or whatever's going on, and you can go and teach in another country and have a completely different experience.
Well, this is what sold me on doing my PGC. Because the last thing I wanted to do, I don't know if I've told this story before, but my dad was deputy head of the school I went to, and I saw the hours he worked, and the last thing I wanted to do was be a teacher. When I was getting towards the end of my philosophy degree and I was thinking, oh crap, what am I going to do next? My dad said, hey, why don't you do teacher training? Because, you know, once you've got that certificate, you can go anywhere in the world. You can always pull out that certificate.
Yeah, and you can always fall back on it. You know what? I was sold on it. It wasn't my father, but I was sold on exactly the same ticket.
Yeah.
That's why I signed up within a month of someone saying that to me. I just thought, that makes a lot of sense. Can you hear me right now?
Yeah. What's up? All right, I think Dai was having some problems with his display there. Dai, you all right now?
I think so. I think an upgrade to Ubuntu had changed the power settings on my screen. So it keeps switching off. But we're back online, so let's go.
Well, that's enough bet anyway for another year. So I see you put some links in here about milk. What's this?
Yeah, no, this is really interesting. So plant-based milk, it probably would be of interest to you, actually, in a certain way. So it's an article in The Guardian, I believe, and it's talking about that plant-based milk is not milk. So milk comes from a lactating mammal and nothing else. So in some milks are spelt with a Y, but it's really interesting to go through. Like almond milk, for example, they talk about it at some point that like it's got two almonds in it only, and really it's just water.
And soy.
Yeah, soy milk is a bit different. But they talk about the rise of oat milk, which I'd never seen before. And this company we're making called Oatly, I think they're called, making oat-based milk. And they started it off in with baristas in coffee shops to make it cool in America. And it's worked really, really well. And now it's going into the main, and they can't make it fast enough, basically. So now you have Quaker and other people, which is a UK oat production company making porridge, etc. They are making their own version of it, and it's supposed to be very good. So because oats are a source of protein anyway, so it's even though it's not milk, it's a milk substitute. And but a really interesting. It's a long read. It's called The Guardian's Lunchtime Read, so it takes you a while to get through it, but it's a really, really interesting article. I recommend reading.
Very good. Very good.
Especially. Yeah, because I've never been quite happy with the idea that we drink baby juice, you know, other animals' baby juice. I don't drink milk very much, but I do have it in my coffee and I have the odd bowl of cereal. But I don't, I'm not.
Yeah, and the way they treat cows isn't great. And the thing is, like, if you think about it too much, so I'm, as I think most people know, pescatarian now, have been for over a year. And so that means, for those who don't know, I eat fish, but not meat, and I still have animal products, I guess, that doesn't kill them. But yeah, anytime I think too much about that position, I'm like, well, that position doesn't make any sense logically. Like, you either go all the way and be vegan or you don't. But it's difficult. It is difficult to do these things. So I see myself on a bit of a journey towards that end of the spectrum, and it is much easier in 2019 to do that.
But I think it talks, I think it talks about being flexitarian, when a lot of people are sort of eating vegetarian or vegan diets for a while and then going back to meat. And I'd consider that, that's what I am. I never cook meat in my, so tonight my supper was scrambled tofu, for example, with vegetables. I never cook meat in my flat, but I don't mind eating meat, and I don't really think too hard about it. It's just what I do. Mm. And but from my point of view, it's like I eat too much meat. But if I were to sit and study my position, I would just have a farm where no animal was ever killed or milked or whatever, you know.
There's an interesting quote in here. It says, so someone from Rebel Kitchen, says, no one is necessarily drinking milk for the nutritional benefits of it. When you're an adult, you're having it because you want something creamy in your drinks. So I think the better the substitutes get. So I think someone was extolling the virtues of like dairy-free ice cream to me the other day. And I'll tell you what, I've started helping with Scouts. And last night, I was giving out the ice cream because they were making like cakes in mugs and using them microwaves or whatever. And I was giving out the ice cream, and I was asking them what their favorite type of ice cream was. And someone said, oh, I like the dairy-free whatever. Not because they're vegan or whatever, just because it tasted so nice. So I think the nicer the alternatives become, the more statements like that about people just wanting something creamy probably ring true.
Well, I had vegan ice cream the other day. So a very good friend of mine here at Oundle, who went vegetarian when you went Presbyterian, Protestant, what were you? Presbyterian. And so, yeah, and so I went around to their house for supper and they gave me this ice cream afterwards and it was delicious. It was just fabulous. I was just like, I want this, not ice cream, please. whatever it is. I don't know what it is. So, and it's one of the things. So I have a big deal about cheese and eggs. So I'd have to deal with that if I went properly vegan or non-animal food consumption. anyway, so it has lots of things, but one of the wacky things about this, right, this article is just reading the story about how much crap it is about the nutritional value of milk. This is the thing. When you do this, it's just so this is not plant milk. This is cow milk. The sugar sort of, yeah, and it's sort of interesting. So people in China, although my Chinese students, who I mentioned this to in the day, I said, "Went what? I can drink milk all I like." Said, but Chinese and Indian people, I think, can't drink cow's milk in the same way that we can. And because they don't produce a certain enzyme that breaks it down in the gut. So here it is. For the majority of humans, production of the enzyme lactase plummets after weaning. From a human perspective, this is quoting someone or other, Adam Fox, to go further than that, from a mammalian perspective, the norm is to be able to tolerate your mother's breast milk and then, as you get past infancy, to stop producing lactase and become lactose intolerant. Well, I just thought this was absolutely insane that someone's saying this to me for the first time, but we have this, you know, because the number of... So my friend in America, who I went to see last summer, she is lactose intolerant and gets a really hard time from all of her brothers for being in a California fad kind of thing. Despite the fact that three of them work for Silicon Valley and she doesn't. But, I just thought it was really interesting. But the science behind it, the actual science behind it is it's bonkers. So people who like, there's a small group of humans have a mutation, which means they maintain production of lactase into adulthood. Northern Europeans, the Maasai in East Africa, some Arab groups as well, but that's the exception, not the rule.
Well, that was a problem with my daughter when she was first born. She couldn't handle milk and came out with a massive rash and was intolerant and then was fine afterwards. So it's interesting. I tell you what is even more interesting, the fact that I've clicked through on the next link that you have shared, which is about, I think, racism and diversity in America. And one of the recommended stories on the BBC website, which I've just put in the show notes as well, is called "I Gave Up Milk for My Health." And if you scroll down on that story, it has a graph. And the graph, after it talks about environmental impact, it talks about people's attitudes to dairy products. And the graph is quite stark because it shows that amongst people who are between 18 and 24%, 18 and 24 years old, 28% of them are cutting back on the amount of dairy consciously cutting back on the amount of dairy that they have, compared to, for example, 5% in the 55 to 64 year old age bracket.
Wow. And then there's a headline here linked to another article, "Canada Drops Milk in Healthy Eating Guide." Misinformation. Oh, wow. Milk alternatives have come under fire for their environmental impact. Sustainable Restaurant Association draws attention to the large amount of water required to make almond milk. Industry body Dairy UK says younger people can be susceptible to misinformation about dairy products and it's planning a campaign on the health benefits.
I think there's disinformation everywhere, and I think that it's easy to replace one thing which harms the planet or harms your health with another. But I think, to my mind, a lot of this is, and I know you'll laugh at this, but when people talk about millennials, they talk about people who were born from 1981 onwards. And my birthday is on the 22nd of December in 1980. And so I am 1 week off being the world's oldest millennial. So I feel like I'm part of that generation, even though I've got gray hair and look older, much older. My attitudes, I feel, are quite similar. I can hear you laughing in the background. But like that generation feels like no reverence to, you know, generations past, because it feels like they don't know what they're talking about. And with Brexit being the culmination of this, like people just not knowing how to govern, not knowing what they're doing, and kind of just rejecting all of that and going their own way.
I just think, I understand what you're saying about millennials. I'm not laughing at you about that, although it is funny. But I think it's, so when I get to my, I live alone, right? So I spend quite a lot of time in my own company. And whenever I come to my, say, quiet space or whatever, where I'm reckoning my footsteps in the world, you know, it's just me in the world. Hello. There's no other people or nothing influencing me, nothing persuading me, nothing making me do anything I don't want to do necessarily. It's a lovely, fortunate position to be in. I don't want to break the planet. I mean, that's where I get to. I don't want to cost the planet anything. Do you know what I mean? I want to make good choices. I want to eat well, look after my body to a certain extent. But that's not my highest priority. It's much more important to me. So I watched this program. It's a fantastic program. You have to watch. Oh my gosh. Anthony Gormley, who did the Angel of the North sculptor. He's got this program on the BBC at the moment called The Origins of Art. Oh my gosh. He's one of my new favorite people. You must watch it. It's so powerful.
Isn't this the one that I recommended to you on Mastodon?
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, then you must watch it. It's no, you might have done anyway. So it's really cool. Oh, you know it is. Yeah, you said you came in a bit of the way through, didn't you?
Yeah, it was about a quarter of the way through, and we turned off something and it was on, and he was just obviously really interested in this Neolithic art and understanding where art was coming from. And a lot of these series, I mean, you've seen it, Dyle, a lot of these series, they jet around the world and they're going on a journey and it's all just bollocks. And they don't visit them in the right order. But he was obviously visiting these places in order and was genuinely blown away by stuff.
Seemed to be making
off-the-cuff remarks, which were extremely insightful. And just, I think you picked up on one that you shared on Mastodon about Picasso and his dismissal of the way that Picasso painted.
Yes, the way that he painted women. So he looks for love in his art, you know, and he says, I can't see the love in this. I don't like this. And he said, it reminds me of Picasso, who was a predator on women and felt he had ownership of them and could take them and break up their form and present it in the ways that he did. And basically just slap Picasso in the face. You know, he just mic dropped him basically. And I was just like, you, my friend, why hasn't anyone ever explained Picasso to me like that before? Do you know what I mean?
So a couple of things. Anthony Gormley, for those who are listening, if you've ever heard of The Angel of the North, which is near me up in Gateshead, it's a huge statue of an angel standing proudly. It's all over the kind of tourist stuff. If you don't know about it, just kind of search it. But there's that. And also, I think you mentioned that you've been to those caves. Or some of them.
No, not all of them. But the Lascaux Caves, yeah, we went twice. We took our children there, which because they're phenomenal. And they're not even real. So you go to these caves, right? And just like the ones he was in. I have no idea if they're the same ones. But whether he got to go in the real ones. But they're basically a mile. The ones you go to as a tourist are a mile down the road from the real ones. And they've recreated them because they were getting so worn and torn by people visiting them. They've recreated an exact replica of it. So it feels, you know, you're under the ground, you're under rocks and everything like that, but they've chiseled out the rocks and made all the forms. So it's all the same kind of thing. And but all the pictures were the same, the dots on the bodies, the way he explained that was phenomenal. The way he explained use of line, the way he got this guy who was spitting at his hand as a way of doing that. And I've seen that in Australia before as well, which he also went to. He flew to Australia to look at the very earliest art that we know of, I think, is in Australia.
The thing I really liked about, there was a couple of things I really liked. There was the obviously doing things in the right order, so that he was going further back and he represented the time really well in terms of the graphics and whatever. But it's easy to look at, you know, old, very old art, like drawings on caves and just look at it and go, great. But he, you know, he was talking about the confidence of the person making the line and how they'd done it in one go. And what really, like such obvious stuff, but the way that he explains it, and he did get that guy, this older guy who ground up charcoal in his mouth and started spitting onto his hand. And I was thinking, well, why don't they just, you know, put their hand in okra and just put it on the wall? But he was saying that, well, anyone can accidentally make a handprint on a wall. But if you spit this charcoal stuff around your hand over the course of 45 minutes or an hour, and you leave the you know, all of this black stuff's around the hand and then it's white or the rock face is on it. You can't do that by accident. So that is art, and that is something where you're intentionally leaving your impact on the world. Just the way he described it was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. No, it was completely, completely great. So I'm just trying to find a link to it now, but I haven't got it. But it's just on the BBC. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not sure. Okay, computer's not doing what I want it to. Here we go. Gormley art.
There's a review actually in the Guardian here, which I'll put in the link.
My link's to the media BBC Media Centre. I'm not sure it's the iPlayer, but it's on there anyway for the next month. So if you're in the UK or you have access to UK BBC, then do have a look. You won't regret it. It's fabulous.
Cool.
Am I going to go to my next link? Is that what we're doing?
We can do, yeah.
Okay, so this is another BBC TV show, actually, which is a documentary of 6 episodes long, I think it was. And it's called Segregated America, A School in the South. So it's about a school, which I can't remember the name of now, but it is 99% African-American students, high school in South Carolina, which I visited when I first went to America. I went to Charleston particularly, but also other places in South and North Carolina. So I watched this. Fantastic. It has some American football in it because that's a big part of what happens at high schools. Some basketball as well, for the same reason. But it was a really interesting thing that they were looking at how America is still segregated by race in the norms of society in a completely accepted way, and that the segregation brings with it all sorts of disparity in funding and socioeconomic circumstances, of course, for the people there. So it's a really, really good watch, basically, for people interested in education, people interested in America. So I just wanted to put that in because I spent...
Yeah, good stuff. And then what's this one? What I learned about Viktor Orban on a road trip with my dad.
This is a beautiful article. It was in The Guardian this morning and it has a video in it. So this is a liberal media maker, a filmmaker who works for The Guardian, and his father is Hungarian. So then his father came over here many, many years ago. And then went back to Hungary after 30 years, I think, and left this man here. So the man is called John Domokos, or Domokos or something. So as far as I could work out, the Hungarian prime minister or president, prime minister at the moment, is called Viktor Orban. And he's a nationalist sort of thing. It seems like a right-wing man, and a lot of people are very upset with him being in power. So John and his dad are unable to talk about politics, and his father hates it. His father wants to talk about politics, but they're not able because they couldn't do it because the younger man resented his father's politics so much because they were so right wing. So he decides to go on this road trip, and they plan out this road trip of different places in Hungary to visit, culminating at a 150-year-old international sausage festival. And as you do, and it's this, and so they're talking and looking and he's trying to introduce his dad to sort of liberal people, like a couple of young female artists who have decided to come back to Hungary and do their art in this small town in Hungary, because without them, if they're not going to be there, then what is going to happen to society? But it was really interesting the way they shied away from politics. They said, we get on with everybody until we talk about politics. And if you talk about politics, people start disliking each other. I thought it was really, really interesting. You know, dysfunction occurs when you talk about politics. But up until that point, even spending long periods of time with people, everything would be fine. And it's quite an interesting thing. So there's a long article here. So you don't have to watch the video, but the video is only 25 minutes long, and it's really, really sweet. And his dad says things like, and it's hard to work out whether he's joking. He says, everything you do is rubbish. It doesn't matter how hard you try, you can't do good at anything. To his son and things like that. And there's lots of things going on. But what this man finds out about his father is that at 6 or 7 years old, his father was hiding from gunfire. And so the Hungarian flag now has the red star cut out of the middle of it. as a symbolic of communist, the overthrowing of communism. And so his father's just so gripped by this right wing culture, because of the set of cards that he's had to play in his life. You know, he had to run from his country. He didn't want to migrate for a better life. He ran from his country in fear of his life. And so keeping this Orban now, this Viktor Orban, the prime minister, is saying things. We are not going to be ruled by an empire anymore. We are not going to be subjects. We are not going to be blah, 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 blah. And that's part of this guy's political platform, if you like. And it's sort of quite interesting about, you know, as nationalism rises in many different places, it's interesting to see this sort of intimate, anecdotal assessment of right-wing politics in Hungary. So it's worth watching.
Oh, interesting. Well, when you said that, it reminded me of an article that I've only skimmed, I have to be honest. And it's an article in the New York Times called "This Is Your Brain Off Facebook." And it cites a study where people who he recruited participants over the age of 18 who spent at least 15 minutes on Facebook every day. The daily average was an hour, and heavy users logged in for 2 to 3 hours or more. So what he did was this Stanford economist and someone from NYU, they recruited 3,000 users who filled in lots of questionnaires, asked about daily routines, political views, state of mind, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Half of the users, I'll just quote from the article, it says, half of the users were randomly assigned to deactivate their Facebook accounts for a month in exchange for payment. The price point for that payment was itself a great interest to the researchers. How much is a month's access to photos, commentary, Facebook groups, friends, and news feeds worth? On average, about $100, the study found, which is in line with previous analysis. So what they found was, basically, let's see if I can find the actual bit where it says, they thought that people were just going to, instead of going on Facebook, go on Twitter and Snapchat and browse the internet or whatever. But actually what they found was that there was a lot less polarization of politics for those who didn't use Facebook at all for the month.
For those that did use Facebook or who did not.
So when they stopped using Facebook, they were less polarized politically.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So Facebook was affecting the extremity of their views, dumbing them down, one might say. Yeah?
Well, yeah. They find that it's just, they get two ends of the spectrum in terms of all of the views and politics and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. There was a lovely tweet that I on Mastodon about the algorithm of Facebook, as in the things that you actually do on it. Did you have something to do with that? Someone was talking about it. Sort of thing, you like another picture of the baby, but you have to do it. Or was it a cartoon?
It was a thing of a dinosaur, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that, yellow backgrounds. It was pretty cool. I liked it.
Greg McVeary. Greg McVeary has been, he is very active in the indie web community. And he's got an indie web page for stuff to do with Facebook. Here we are, Facebook criticism. I'll stick the link in the show notes. And one of them is the thing I want to talk about next, actually. But it does have this lovely cartoon in it, which is a dinosaur. And it's got a Facebook simulator, a comic to use when Facebook is down. And it's got like... another friend is now posting lyrics from angry breakup songs. Let's like that too.
Yeah, yeah. Next up, there's a sponsor post that says you won't believe what's blowing up Kickstarter. You'll easily believe it, though. It's just a weird belt or something moving along. Ooh, look, another friend posted a picture of their baby, even though literally everyone she knows has already seen that baby. Well, I don't like it.
The interesting thing for me is that half of this I don't even understand because I haven't been on Facebook for 9 years.
Oh, I understand all of this, but and it's not particularly accurate, but it's close enough to make you think, fuck yeah. Excuse my language.
Anyway, the thing I want to move on with Facebook was that they have been found to be paying teenagers to install a VPN via like a root certificate on their phone. which is in violation of Apple's terms and conditions. They've been paying people, mainly teenagers, but between the age of 13 and 35, about $20 a month to not only install this Facebook search app and harvest up all their data, but obviously also to take screenshots of any Amazon purchases. So they're trying to like find out what people are into who are young.
Is that what it's for? Are they just trying to connect users' behavior to purchase?
Anyway, it's caused absolute ructions because Facebook and Apple aren't on the best terms anyway. It's in violation of Apple's terms and conditions. So Apple basically revoked all of Facebook's like developer certificates so that they couldn't do anything.
All right, yeah. Okay. So, it's gone or gone off their platform anyway. I guess it will still work on Android. Because no one has any rights. Android is open and deadly, I guess, in that way.
So that's really that cool. Page.
I think that's really interesting and absolutely inevitable. I'd like to give a shout out for the article that I mentioned last time we spoke, actually, the Wired interview between Tristan Harris and Yuval Noah Harari about how to hack the human or how humans are being hacked. It's really got some good stuff in there about how you cannot compete against 2 billion 2 billion human computerized human users, as in the information. It's just our brains just aren't good enough. They are going to beat us. But that's interesting. So what I would argue, that VPN that spies on them, the app that spies on them, is what Facebook are looking for is how do we really connect advertising to purchasing. This is the thing. So we're feeding these ads at people, and there's lots of ideas. You know, you add 50 times, see the ad 50 times, all of a sudden this product becomes something that you desire and eventually will purchase. And I like that. And how Instagram is just so that it's to look at Instagram now, you're getting the pictures of your friends' feeds, right? But actually you get like every fifth photo you get like an ad, and it becomes essentially a shop front. A personalized shop front is what's going on. And it needs to be called what it is. Do you know what I mean? It's like being on Amazon all of the time, but just with some chat from your mates while you're going.
That's true.
It's kind of what's happening. And it's an interesting thing. How on earth did they ever make this happen? But they have. And it's fascinating.
It's incredible, isn't it? And it's what happens when you throw a lot of money at something until it then brings you back a lot of money. So I'm sure, as everyone knows by now, Mark Zuckerberg has said that he wants to merge Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and Instagram, which, one person explained it, although not in the article that I'm linking to, it basically, he talks about encryption and talks about, you know, being able to share in a seamless way between all different platforms. But it also creates like a massive encrypted surveillance garden for them.
Yes, completely. I think it's when you realize what these companies are doing with your data and how they're selling to you and doing all of these things and how they are manipulating your behavior, how you are being hacked. Again, why I raised that article about the Wired thing from last week. It's just bizarre that we're letting ourselves be subjected to this. And we will look back in 30 years' time and go, what did people really think was going on? Probably. Maybe not.
Yes. So there we are. Now then, we're doing this here thing in a bit of a random order today, because that was kind of, usually we say what we've been up to. In this case, we're both a bet. You say what you've been up to, I say what I've been up to, and then we go through a bunch of links. But today, what we've just been talking about was kind of, I don't know, mixed in with what you've been up to. So if I, there's a couple of things I want to talk about, if that's all right, before we dive into the links. And the first of these was that before Bet, we had a very brief, only one day co-op meetup. So this is We Are Open Co-op. Laura Hilliger, who we've already mentioned, wrote things up on the We Are Open blog. And the only person who wasn't there was John Bevan. So there's five of us, and John wasn't there, so there's four of us, which is Brian Mothers, Gronia Hamilton, Laura Hilliger, and me. And the work that we've done to date has been mainly around edtech and a lot around open badges, that kind of stuff, and working openly. And Gronia makes soap. And she makes fantastic soap, and she makes like balms and other things, and doesn't use plastic, and everything's sustainable. And it's, I bought my wife, Hannah, some of this stuff for Christmas, and it was incredible, absolutely fantastic stuff, with a Scottish twist as well. And Laura is quite a job at Greenpeace, and she is working on a book at the moment called Maybe Zombies. So very creative endeavors. I do something which some people might think is creative, which is curate thought shrapnel. And Brian is obviously not only draws things, but is also remixing programmable, remixable web apps and stuff. And none of this is really represented so far in what we do with the co-op. So Laura came along with the idea of reimagining ourselves as like an artist collective. And I said, well, I don't really see myself. I don't self-identify as an artist as such, but I do self-identify as being creative. So maybe we could be a creative collective. And we talked about how this would work, etc. Anyway, what we decided is that that's what we're going to do after getting the go-ahead from John. He called it a bit of a semantic reorganization, which is fair enough, but it's really just expanding the scope of what we do. So we'll still do all the edtech stuff and badges and whatever, but it means that, for example, Gronja on her LinkedIn profile is comfortable with putting that she makes soap alongside the fact that she does e-assessment, like much more holistic, encompassing view of who we are and what we do, and trying to be less corporate and businessy, and much more talking about who we are and how we feel.
I think that's, I mean, it's a difficult thing. I think that there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't do that. I think that trying to pigeonhole everything, I think putting the word creative on the top of it, kind of does my noggin in a little bit. I kind of want you to find different language for it than that, in a way.
Well, it's not necessarily that we're going to redo our whole page and stuff. It's more to do with giving ourselves permission to represent ourselves holistically.
No, I think that's really cool. I think that's a really good idea, and you should pursue it. And people are full of interesting expertise, and because, or experience that is expertise to one degree or another. And it might well be that people need, people just think, oh no, I'm going to make a newsletter and it's going to go fine. But actually it might be that some consultancy about how you deliver information to people, to a distributed network of people, that they are self-subscribing to, is really quite a big deal, which I think it is.
Now, there's a way of doing this.
It's a bit like podcasting as well, Doug, you see. So you could do it on podcasting too. And that you have not just the technical thing, but the actual, the nature, you know, why is Tide so hot dang good? and whatever, I don't know. But
well, Laura shared, so there's a guy called Mark Boas who we used to work with at Mozilla and some other people, and they've got this thing called Bad Idea Factory. Now, I know you're going to roll your eyes at this. It's a very well-conceived kind of thing. But Bad Idea Factory is a collective of chaotic creatives using technology to make people thinking face emoji. We have been working in this space for hundreds of thousands of years. And the three options you have are submit an idea, give us money, or engage our services. And if you go to their Patreon, then if you give them $15,000 a month, they will shut down for the amount of time that you are backing them on Patreon.
I do see this. They have this thing at the top called Portfolol rather than Portfolio. It's going to laugh out loud on the end. That's kind of cool.
I mean, the stuff they've done is pretty cool. But these are guys who are just very talented, very connected. They're working with the BBC, and they've got been funded by the Knight Foundation and whatever. So they can put all kinds of stuff on. Like if you scroll right to the bottom of their page, they've got testimonials, which has the subtitle, Sticks and Stones Can Break Our Bones, but...
No, it's cool. It keeps it light, doesn't it? I like it.
Yeah, so we're not looking to like be crazy, but at the same time, we're just giving ourselves permission to do things a bit differently. So that's what we're doing. Which takes me to something which I saw on Paul Jarvis's newsletter. Paul Jarvis has got a new book called Company of One, why staying small is the next big thing for business. And he has been doing all kinds of stuff about making things which are sustainable on a small scale. And he writes this fantastic newsletter about, you know, being, you know, a creative person and doing things by yourself called Sunday Dispatches. And in his most recent newsletter, Sunday Dispatches, he did like a greatest hits, things which people have liked. And one of them was just called, what was the title? I think it was called, Fuck Stats, Make Art. That's right. And there's a particular bit which stood out to me, which I quoted in Thought Shrapnel, and it says, what makes the content you create awesome is that it's a story told through your unique lens. It's you telling a story. It's not you giving a fuck about anything but telling that story. It doesn't matter if it's a blog post about banking software or a video of how to make nut milk. The content will be better if you let your real personality shine. End of quote.
I think that's very true. I like that. It's interesting, the idea. I mean, he's a co-op. You're a co-op person. But the idea of businesses staying smaller, I think, is a really interesting thing. It's been really, really obvious that being a startup that's slave to the million users and then to the venture capitalist and then to the IPO, it's really quite a dull thing. And so many people have left their very successful organizations and started up new ones that is a lesson in itself, really, about what it is that makes for a good life.
I just think that we worry too much. Like, it starts at school. Like that will go on your record, or, you know, talking about things looking good for your CV or whatever. And who's the audience? Who's the audience for this? Who's the audience for your CV? Who cares, right? Because it used to be the case that you had a job for life, and then it became the case of you had not many jobs and you had to make sure that, you know, you kept your nose clean and did all this stuff in between jobs. And now, like, you've got celebrities on Twitter swearing here, there and everywhere, talking about politics, doing this and whatever. Nobody cares. Like, people hire awesome people. And yes, okay, they might sack you if you're extremely right wing or, you know, all the things that you should be sacked for, racist, whatever. But if you're awesome, you can do whatever you want. You can have a side hustle as, you know, selling bananas at the market or whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, express yourself.
I think that's an important thing.
So there we are. One other thing which we did, which was fun, which I should probably mention last week, was that we had finished kind of talking about what we're going to do and this new approach. And Brian doesn't have a TV. Brian has got a projector in his living room, which he plays games with his kids on and also watch films on it. And he's got it hooked up to his laptop. And you've used Kahoot before, Di, I think. So I've used Kahoot and presentations and whatever. It's been around a while, and he'd had great fun with his kids, with them all making their own Kahoot quizzes and getting everybody to answer them using their smartphones to answer. So we did that, and that was fun. And I thought, oh, hang on a minute. Back at home, I've used something called Air Console with my kids, which you put on. I've got a NVIDIA Shield, which is an Android box underneath the TV, and you use that, just anything which can bring up the Air Console website, and then you use the Air Console app on your phone or tablet or whatever, and you can use that to control what's on Air Console. So I thought, well, there must be other things like this, and I came across an awesome thing called Multior. And so we put Multior on the projector screen and controlled it using our smartphones. And you're a meteor and you've got to destroy everything and you can see everyone else. And it's just very slick, very simple and fantastic. Loads of fun.
That looks awesome. I like the fact that you went looking for games that didn't have a download factor, so you could just get on with it.
Yeah. But the next one we played, so I found a list on Reddit of useful stuff, but a lot of those you had to buy via the Steam marketplace. But there was one which was hilarious. And Di, I haven't played this after having a drink, but I can imagine it would be even more fun. So you don't need a projector for this. You just need your phone. And it's called Space Team. and it describes itself as a cooperative shouting game for phones and tablets. And the what you do is you connect over Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or whatever it finds, even across Android and iOS and stuff. And what you have to do is you're on a spaceship and you've got all these controls in front of you, like release the spigot or increase the multi-warble to from 1 to 4. And it gives you instructions, but the instructions aren't for your controls. They're for someone else's controls. So you don't know who's got the controls. So you have to shout out the control and they have to change it. Otherwise, the ship starts falling apart. And it's a game you just have to play. It's great fun. And you shouting at each other.
That sounds like a perfect game for a boarding house. That's what I say. I'm going to do it. I'm going to get on it and get in third form. Shouting at each other loudly. They'd love that.
It's lovely. And then Laura put me on. So I used to work with Bobby Richter and Luke Pacholski at Mozilla. And they created a game last year called Paddle Force, which is like, it's not for mobile. It's for desktop. And you use like WASD and D and the cursor keys to play against each other. And it's like Pong on steroids. Like you get certain power-ups and all this kind of stuff. Which is great fun. And then, do you remember a game called Super Off-Road?
Possibly.
At the arcades. There's a game, a much more simple version of this that Luke's created called Pixel Drift. So it just got me back into really simple, fun games, multiplayer games. So just wrote a quick blog post on Thought Shrapnel, sharing a link to all those.
Oh, okay, cool. I know that's brilliant. Power Paddle Force looks great. We make paddle on Scratch and with the second form, so it'd be quite cool to pimp it up a little bit and have an example of it being really cool. And it is just really basic. I'm loving it. but it's good gameplay. This is what I always say to them. So what we do is make Scratch and make Pong on Scratch, and then I say you have to pimp your Pong. And so all the kids then start pimping their Pong, and some of them do it putting two players in and different reasons, different obstacles, making it faster, making it too fast, you know, ramping up each level and all that kind of thing, and get quite inventive with it. So that looks really cool.
Yeah, good stuff.
I like it.
And you're right, that's absolutely the right place to start. There's that website called Glitch, glitch.io. And that's what Grace, my daughter, did at MozFest. Started using a really simple game. And then because you can quickly change all the different things in, you know, the HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, changing not only how it looked, but how it played as well. And there's nothing, like, I think with kids, I think that's the place to start, not designing web pages and things. It's pimping games.
Games are a real hook. I mean, that's the only thing that, as I said, the thing about the robots earlier, is I thought, okay, I had this conversation. Have you tried VR at BET or anywhere?
I didn't try at BET, but Gavin Henrik, who was at Moodle, has got a Vive, and so I've used that.
And what did you do with it? What did you do?
What do we do? I went on a roller coaster, went underneath the sea. I played Skyrim VR. Cool. Played like a shooty game.
So educational content. Do you remember that time? I don't know if we've talked about this before, but in EdTech Roundup many, many years ago, Tom Barrett was on, and he was working with Hitachi smart boards at the time, and they come up.
Oh, the touch table.
Yeah. They come up with this table which could have like 4 or 6 users at one time, and you know, you touched it, and it made the water ripple and stuff. It was all kind of great. And they came on, and he wanted to know what uses were. He said, Hitachi want to know what uses in the classroom are there for this, and I was just quite convinced there were none. And it had no place in my classroom. And that's what I sort of think about VR. And I'm looking for something that is making it worthwhile, right? So I've talked to my digital leaders about this. We went through it. We talked about, okay, we could do an immersive lesson observation as like a PR video for people looking at the school. We could, and where they could look around the room and see what was going on at different places in the room during a lesson. We could, you know, and we were looking at that, doing like tours of the school, but tours are like, you know, you don't want people not to come to the school. You want them to see something that they wouldn't be able to see otherwise. And a lesson observation sort of works with that. So anyway, looking at different reasons, but none of the reasons were good enough. And so I sat next to this Rachel Evans, who is this digital lead at Wimbledon High School, and I said about VR, and she said she got some headsets in. She got 3 year 8 girls in, didn't tell them what she was doing, made them close their eyes, and put the headset on them. Then they drew with light, so you can draw with light in these headsets, right? You can change the light, so you color a light that you use and the intensity of the light.
Oh, I've used that as well. Google Tilt Brush, is it called?
Yeah, sounds pretty awesome. But I've not used it myself, I don't think, although I do have seen it, maybe just a video, maybe. And she said the girls were so excited. They were screaming and shrieking and having such a good time. She said it's definitely got a place in it. And I just thought, okay, so what you're saying to me now is that for a pupil to have those high-end emotional responses in school, well, surely that's got to be good. It's good. It's good to have that shrill, that high, you know, that high intensity emotional experience whilst in your school buildings, quite literally in your uniform with your school friends in your school setting. That's a good thing. Okay, maybe I'm just being a grumpy old sod. Am I?
I don't know. Like I'm always very influenced by what Audrey Waters writes about stuff. And so she wrote, oh, a good 3-4 years ago, I put a link in there, Minimum Viable EdTech, the VR edition. And she talks about Google Expeditions, which is where I've tried this because you can use it with just a phone, put in one of those. I've got the equivalent of Google Cardboard, but it's like a more comfortable headset. Mm-hmm. And you put your phone in there and someone else can control your experience. Like they can take you from one place to another. It gives you teacher notes, all this kind of stuff, Google Expeditions. And she was pointing out that this is likely to lead to greater inequality. So the poor kids will get the VR version and the rich kids will get to go there, really. But what I've realized recently, having tried VR both on just the phone, and that's getting better, and on the Vive, and then there's new ones coming out this year because they were showcased at CES this month, is that it's never... or it's usually and. So I did, when I went down to London, one of the things I haven't mentioned is after BET, I went to the British Library and I saw the Anglo-Saxons exhibition at the British Library, mm-hmm. which was great. And I was very lucky to get a ticket at the last minute. And I went round and I thought, if I took kids here, it'll be the same old story of rushing round or you give them some kind of quiz and they rush it and they don't really watch it. But if you can take them there beforehand and basically scaffold their attention of the things that they should really look at when they're there, that's a whole different matter. So I've been using the Google Art and Culture app recently, which just have a VR element to it, and going to different art galleries around the world. Because, yeah, you could go on Google Images or any kind of like Bing image search or whatever and look for those artworks. But it's different when you go in VR, is almost as if you're there and you see it in its surrounding with everything around it as well, in context. And you kind of almost, you're not walking, but you're like browsing them in order together as a set. Like there's something about that, I think.
Yes, I think there is. Although you could argue, you could just show them a video and say, look, pay attention to that when you go around. It's really interesting.
It's not the same, though. And I'll tell you why it's not the same.
Sorry, that was me being cynical. I was being flippant.
No, but this is the point that Audrey makes. It's that what's the difference between VR and educational video? And I think she makes a point. Like if it's literally just put a VR headset on and just do something which you could have had an expert tell you stuff on an educational video, fair enough. But when you're in there, it's completely immersive. You can't see someone trying to distract you out of the corner of your eye in the classroom. You can do anything you want. You've got potentially things to do with your hands. And this is the reason why I was so blown away by the fact that I actually managed to watch that Anthony Gormley thing, because I cannot watch TV. It's so, like, it lacks so much information density, usually, that I need to control it in some way. I need something to do with my hands. I want it to hurry up. Whereas when you're controlling the experience, you can walk wherever you want. Yeah, you're constrained by, the particular VR area that's being recorded, but you can go anywhere, look at anything, see what's going on, control the experience. And I think there's something about that. I really do. I don't think it's the kind of thing where my wife and I earlier were talking about when they used to wheel the TV in, to our primary school when we were younger. It's not like that. It's not like wheeling in the VR headsets, but there is a place for it, of setting a sense of place. Or I remember talking about Tom Barrett. He used to use the Wii for this, of getting them to play a game and then do creative writing about what it's like underneath the sea, rather than just reading books, like playing the game, being immersed in it, seeding the imagination. That's what it's about.
Fair shout. I'll buy that bit. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the elephant in the room.
So today we launched the initial test of MoodleNet. And if you don't know what MoodleNet is, then I haven't done a very good job of explaining this on the podcast. MoodleNet is a resource-centric social network for educators. At least that's how it's starting out. So there's the concept of a minimum viable product. So this is the smallest thing you can build, which allows people to test your value proposition. And our value proposition is, do educators want to join communities to curate collections of resources? So how can you make that minimal on the one hand, and why is it taking so long to build another? Well, it's minimal because you can only add resource by URL. You can take things that exist on the web and you can curate them into collections. It's very simple. There's bugs, there's things that don't work, there's features that you would expect that haven't been built. But the reason it's taken so long is because we've been building out the back end. So if you're used to things like Mastodon or Pleroma or decentralized social networks, these are things that anyone can install, open source software, and they federate together. So just like email, Dai can use his school email address and email me at my Moodle email address, and it just works. The same can happen of social networks too. And we're going to exploit that fact using a protocol called ActivityPub. So soon you'll be able to install your own version of MoodleNet, curate your own resources on your own instance, on your own server, but also you'll be able to message people and share resources and be part of communities all over the federated instances of MoodleNet. So.
Cool. Sounds good.
So that's that. We committed to launching this initial test in two languages, at least two languages, so it's Spanish and English, in January of this year, which is what we've done. We're a part-time team, so I work 4 days. Alex currently works 5 days, but he's going to go down to 3 or 4 days. Mael and Ivan, so they work 3 and 2 days respectively. So they're very talented, and I'm very pleased with the progress we've made. But I think people expect them, you know, they expect to go in there and it's going to be like Twitter or Pinterest or something. But the thing that people forget, and maybe I should link to something I wrote on this, is that, okay, it's 2019, it's not 2007, but there's a big difference between how things are when they start out and how they end up when they gain mainstream adoption. And that's where we're at with MoodleNet. So I put a link in here to something called Using Twitter as a Lens for Some Thoughts on Launching Products. So I'm the product manager, I'm MoodleNet lead, and things go wrong. Things break. So today we finally send out the email invitations to people. I test it with people who are my employees and my colleagues and our employees at Moodle HQ. And a lot of the emails are going into spam. So we had to tweak that. Then when we sent them out, people do unexpected things. Even though you direct them as to which button to click on, they try to log in even though they haven't registered yet. And then you make some kind of change based on feedback and you push the latest update and it breaks something which wasn't under your team's control. And MoodleNet is down for 2 hours, only an hour after it's launched. And then it's fixed. And then Stephen Downes, who's extremely well known in the world of online learning and ed tech, just tweets out that he's created a 13-minute video on his first impressions of MoodleNet. And so you're continually, as a product manager, biting your fist, waiting for the next thing to happen.
yes, that is. So it's very odd. I guess he's a Moodle user, eh?
He is, and I really appreciate him doing this. And he's done it in a positive way, I would say. The two things, if you do watch his video, which is linked from there, first of all, the metadata import. So when you put a URL, if you copy and paste a URL into MoodleNet, for most websites, not all of them, including Stephen Downes's, it will pull in like the title and the image and the description and all that kind of stuff automatically. It didn't for Stephen's example in there, although it did for another one that he put in there. Another thing is he missed, and maybe this is something we need to make more prominent, that when you go into a community, there's three levels for MoodleNet. There's communities who curate collections of resources. In the community level, there's collections, but there's also another tab for discussions, and he missed that, and I pointed that out to him, but it's not in the video.
Okay.
So that's okay, that.
Well, I'm glad he wasn't too nasty.
No, he wasn't at all. He just pointed out things that he would expect and, you know, things that he's noticed. For example, you know, if a modal pops up and you click out of the modal, you lose all of the text that you've entered, you know, if you do that automatically. So little things, and people have been given feedback already, and lots of people have created communities and started curating resources and stuff. Had some positive feedback of people saying, oh, I had to stop myself from using it and get on with some work because I was really enjoying just importing all these resources. So you'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I think potentially it has, because it's not tied to Moodle, is it? So it's potentially anybody can go, just pop in there and go and have a look for resources that they might like to use on their courses that have been curated by other people doing the same job that they're doing or a similar job to what they're doing, which is always a good thing.
That's right. So if I just give you some stats, this is the third iteration of MoodleNet. The first one was like Moodle Hubs. And then there was a version which was at Moodle.net, which allowed you to basically share Moodle content. So like a whole Moodle course, you'd export it and you put it into MoodleNet. So I looked at the stats yesterday. And since 2010, there were only 289 courses shared in what? 8 years?
No, I think that's huge. So I've used this before, this repository, I think, of courses for Moodle, and basically, or maybe not that one, but a similar one. And the problem with it is, when you make a course, you never really feel like it's finished unless someone's paying you to make it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. As a teacher, you're always busy. There's always things pulling you in other directions and stuff like that. And that's why I really like this, because what I would do is if I found a resource, I would very happily share that resource and give it a little evaluation and say why I thought it was good and what it did and tag it and whatever and curate that resource for others to access. But if you want my course, well, I don't even work in courses anymore.
No, I don't think anyone does. I think that's the thing. That's what I was really surprised at. So a couple of things which I found with Moodle courses. Firstly, they're really difficult to export and import. Secondly, if I was looking for resources, I'd want to know what was in the course before I downloaded it. And thirdly, I wouldn't download an entire course just to get a few resources. And also, I wouldn't share my entire course either, because... As you say, who's to say it's finished?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, you're to say it's finished, but you don't necessarily want to. And it's like, so when do you share it? Okay, I finished this course. Now I'm going to share it. Oh, no, I'm going to teach it first. And then I'll be able to tweak it and make it better before I teach it again next year. But then when you get to the end of that, do you really go and share it? I just found that it wasn't the case so much. And I think I like the idea of sharing resources, not sharing courses. And I think Moodle has to contain that. It's a really, really lovely thing. It was Amy Burville introduced me to a guy called Nick Shackleton-Jones, I think he's called, who works in learning and development. Introduced me to his work. And he has some really good ideas about the idea of courses in, so learning and development is basically schools for industry, essentially. And it's what you do when somebody joins your firm, the courses that they have to do to train up to get to be able to do their job. And the companies will have a lot of branding, corporate sort of philosophies or whatever ways things are done in that organization that people need to learn that they don't get shown. They need to spend some time on an online course. And and so he talks about the idea of resources. And what you do is you provide a bank of resources to people, and they go in and you use them, because people remember resources, but they don't remember courses.
Mm.
So it's a really interesting sort of psychological shift as to what you think might actually be going on for the individual. And resources make a lot more sense. It's like, here's a really, and one of the examples he uses is the tube map. He says, you don't put a course together about how to ride the tube. He says, you give someone a tube map and that's a resource. And you can give people other version things that will help them navigate the tube. Do you see what I mean?
Definitely. And I mentioned I saw Alan O'Donohoe at SPET. And he, you know, this Moodle Net didn't just appear from nowhere. It wasn't me just having a cool idea one day. It came from lots of conversations internally at Moodle, and then going out to people like Stephen Downes and talking, you know, regularly, sometimes for scheduled discussions with people like Stephen and Amber Thomas at Warwick, and about 30, 35 people, Alan Levine, Martin Hawksey, a lot. But also people who I'm talking with all the time, like the guys on Slack and UDI and whatever. Mm-hmm. And Alan O'Donohoe said something which really crystallized things for me, which was when I spoke to him, he said, well, you know, being on a social network is like waiting for treasure to arrive every day. Like you try and follow the right people, and eventually you hope that they're going to share something that you didn't even know you were looking for. So you've got this kind of reactiveness, but also you've got the proactiveness of trying to search through all these resources. So I was trying to create something which married those two together. If there are two ends of the spectrum, something mm-hmm. where you could find things that you didn't know you were looking for, but also if you were looking for something, you could find things on that particular subject. Now, the thing that I haven't mentioned yet is that the collections are limited to 10 resources per collection. And that's because it's very much about curation rather than just, here's everything I've ever found on this particular subject. Like, it has to be the top 10.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it, as an idea. It reminds me of Jason Evans, who wrote J.E. Malek, the memory allocation script or whatever, and for Facebook, and is now, you know, retired at 40, he's a millionaire. He set basically that a piece that the memory allocated would be, once executed, would only be available for 10 seconds. And he chose the 10 seconds quite randomly. And that 10 second block was just a complete winner. It just worked for all the script to assemble, do the thing. It's presented on the screen. If nobody touches it, the memory in the computer is reallocated to be used for something else while that thing stays on the screen. Mm. And it was that sort of, yeah, that 10 second rule was a stroke of genius, apparently. So maybe that will be the same for MoodleNet, isn't it?
Well, I hope so. And there's lots of things that we need to figure out. And it's, you know, it's not ready for the screaming hordes to come and use yet. But it is very much testing this value proposition. And I think we're onto something here. But we'll see. We'll see what kind of feedback we get. I'm going to put the first survey out. We were going to launch on Wednesday, so I was going to put the survey out tomorrow. But instead, I'll put the survey out on Monday. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating seeing people using things unexpectedly.
In your R&D, have you looked at Rockfig?
Yes, that's the one where you share... there's like schematics or something.
I can't remember. No, it's a resource sharer, I think. And Susan Bannister used to work for them, who also used to work for VLE companies and now works in anti-slavery, of all things.
I'm not thinking. I've just looked at it. It's not the thing I was thinking of. Okay. Well,
maybe that's worth checking out. I don't know. Anyway. Cool.
Well, I mean, the thing is, right, just to say, for those who, because I haven't really, I've talked about the federated nature, but the biggest difference here is it's not hard to create a centralized resource sharing website, but these things come and go, and you have to try and keep the community there and monetize it in some kind of way. So TES does this, Rockfig does this, Canvas have got one, teachers pay teachers, whatever, like a centralized kind of place where you come and, you know, find stuff. But the thing about MoodleNet, and the thing which is the reason why I'm working for Moodle on this, is because it's decentralized. So you can install your own one and configure it however you want. You could disconnect it if you wanted to from the rest of MoodleNet and just run it by yourself. Uh-huh. It's not trying to be just a silo, a centralized silo.
No, because it's going to be a useful integrated tool within into Moodle as well, isn't it? The two products.
It will be, yes. So there'll be a plugin so that eventually, so you can take a collection of resources from MoodleNet and put it into your Moodle course. And also you'll be able to take a resource from your Moodle course and put it into a MoodleNet collection. Now, obviously, we're going to integrate with MoodleNet, but this is open source software. So there's nothing stopping any third parties, you know, when we have an API, whatever we want to do, integrating with MoodleNet so that, you know, maybe we're not stopping other learning management systems doing that, but it might be, I don't know, anyone could do anything. You could integrate it with your, what's it called, MIS, about, you know, your teachers. So you automatically put them in there, whatever you want, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I think we should sum up. It's nearly 10 o'clock.
Oh, sorry. Well, just to say that if you are interested in testing MoodleNet, you can't at the moment, but if you go to new.moodle.net, we have a page which tells you a bit more about it and also allows you to sign up. So there we are.
Cool. Good work. Okay. Right, what are you up to this week then?
Just to say the things we didn't get to, which I'll put in the show notes, hierarchies and large organizations, about why we weren't meant to have a boss. Cal Newport's got a new book out. He was the author of Deep Work, and he's got an interview in GQ talking about the dangers of techno-maximalism. His book will arrive in Belshaw Towers next week, so I'll be reading some of that. What about exit option democracy? So this is basically talking about the fact that you can't realistically operate in 2019 and say, well, I'm not going to use Facebook or Google or Twitter or anything like that. Like, there is no option to do that. And it's based on someone's talk. Another one about, it's not just about the quality of your work, but the volume of your work as a quality in and of itself. And the last one is kind of a fun one, which is kind of a remix of TeachMeet, but not necessarily for educators, called Drink, Talk, Learn. And if you go over your 3-minute allocated session, you have to down your drink, which you must have in your hand at all times.
Sounds like my kind of TeachMeet right there.
Okay, what are you up to this week then, Dan?
Safer Internet Day next week. So I've charged, I'm having an A3 poster made by my digital leaders. The digital leaders are doing some really cool work, actually. They're building systems. So one of them is, we have a bar in our common room, like a proper pub things. And so he's built a system for charging people in that, with automating emails out to them to let them know how much they spend each month that goes directly off their wages. What else have they been doing? They've built systems for the chemistry department to book out equipment and for experiments and on the timetables. The technicians know when to do all of this, which has been a paper-based system and then a spreadsheet-based system, but now he's made a proper good system for them, so that's in development. We're looking at badging chemistry lab skills. We're looking at badging design and technology machine health and safety certificates. We're looking at, what else are they doing? Oh yes, so there's another big thing they're taking on, which is to create a system that helps teachers plan trips in great detail. So it's going to be a sort of a complement and a guide for teachers to make sure. So trips are becoming notoriously hard. There's pieces of software out there which aren't that all that, apparently. I haven't seen it yet. So they're going to join a webinar next Wednesday, I hope, with this company. And then they're going to unbeknownst to the company, who hopefully don't listen to this podcast, they're going to recreate their software and make it better and suitable for our school. So I've got some fantastic programmers in the Digital Leaders this year. I just run Programming Club tonight, finished at 6:15. That was really cool. So kids coming in and programming what they want. Just so they're all getting on with their own little projects in different ways. There's a bit of gaming going on. There's people going into SQL. There's people going into Unity. There's people just on Code Combat, I think, which we've talked about in the past.
Oh, yes.
As well as doing little individual projects and just pursuing their own lines of inquiry, which is a real refreshing thing to do, because it's not what I normally do in my classroom. So I'm enjoying that, despite the fact it finishes at 6:15. And then, so next week is Safer Internet Day. So what else am I doing? Oh yeah, I've just formed the Digital Strategy Research Group. So I've assembled five other heads of department from a various range of subjects. And we had our first meeting yesterday lunch, so we'll have another meeting next week. And we're looking to research where our strategy should go, whether we should go one-to-one computers in the school, or whether we should remain in an ad hoc system where teachers can simply ask the students to bring the computer to the lessons where they are required. And this is the idea of protecting and what we're expert in the classroom already. Sort of controversial digital strategy. It's not one that you'll find in many schools, but I like it. But it's not necessarily the right thing. And that's me.
Very good. Well, I will spend tomorrow. What am I going to do tomorrow? I'm seeing what people do, responding to any questions, criticism, praise, anything like that from MoodleNet. Getting things ready for next week. I am taking my wife out for lunch so that, because it's the 1st of February, she can have her first glass of wine of 2019. So I said that I'd take her out for lunch to do that.
Excellent. Make sure you find a nice restaurant.
Well, I'm choosing the only one which is of any decent standard in Morpeth, which I can walk to, which is Bar Luger in the middle of Morpeth. Oh. But yeah, she's a lady of leisure these days.
Take her to some fancy wine bar in Newcastle.
No. It's lunchtime. I can't go that far. And I kind of mentioned in passing earlier that I've been for the last over a year secretary of the local scouts, and they needed some more hands, as it were. So I've found myself in the position of assistant scout leader now, which is great. And I went to the first session on Wednesday, and I already know a lot of the kids because they're the same age as Ben, our eldest. Gone really well with them, had a great time, and just really looking forward to getting stuck into that. But I've got a bit of admin to sort out. I've got to do like online training and fill in forms and all that stuff.
It's a bit like DV, I imagine. Although I don't have to do any admin for that, actually, so it's not like DV. I wish you luck with that. That's a really cool thing to get involved in, community project and giving up your time. I know.
Well, it's not even selfless. It's the fact that I really miss teaching, particularly that age group, like 11 to 13, Key Stage 3. Okay. I really miss teaching. Like, if I had any choice of the kids to go back and teach, I'd just teach that age.
Okay, I'd buy that. I'm not teaching 11 to 13 this year, which I have done for the last 4 years here and previously. And I agree. There's a sort of uncool enthusiasm about it all, which is kind of brilliant. Yeah.
Yep, so really enjoying that. Need to get that sorted out. Then next week, 4 days on MoodleNet, 1 day doing my own thing. And given that I've been working all the hours and thinking all the hours about MoodleNet, I might just play. And now, I haven't mentioned this yet, Red Dead Redemption 2, which is something I bought a couple of weeks ago. And it is unbelievable.
Really. Is it really good? I've been thinking about what do you use? What platforms are on?
PlayStation 4.
PS4. I've been thinking about getting into gaming a little bit.
I mean, it's that, you know, we talked about VR and immersion and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I took my son to see Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and was blown away by that. Just because, like, the philosophical angle of it is amazing. Red Dead Redemption 2 is pretty brutal. Like, I won't let my kids play it. It's an 18. But it's beautiful, and it's a sandbox game, and you can go anywhere you want. But it is, I play it on my projector connected, you know, to all the speakers and the PlayStation and stuff. And I've spent all day looking at screens, but yet I go in there and it doesn't feel like that. It feels like just chilling out in the countryside whilst occasionally like shooting people and slitting their throat. But you know, it's just,
that sounds awesome. I want to do that. It really does. Okay, cool.
So that's what I'm doing.
Okay, well, I'm jealous. Well, Joe. excellent. Well, I hope everything goes well with Moodle now. Obviously, that's a big project and you're delivering at the moment and working under a lot of pressure. So I wish you well with it.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, if you're listening to this, and you as well, Di, if you want to get involved with the testing for that, we'll need a lot more people for the next round of testing. So new.moodle.net if you want to...
When's your kick date for the new round of testing, do you think?
About the 18th of February-ish.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Cool. That's when I'm going to be on a half term. But also possibly out of the country. We'll see. Okay. Very good. It was lovely to talk, as always. And very interesting stuff.
Cheers, everyone.
Bye-bye. I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.